Good morning. We have two issues that the court has accepted transfer on, from each side. Try as I might, I've not been able to figure out which one the court has greater interest in. So I'll proceed by default in the sequence according to how we briefed them below, as well as here in this court. The bottom line is, the judgment needs to be restored with no comparative fault and with full prejudgment interest. I'll address the comparative fault outlook submission first, the prejudgment issue second. Two things on the lookout or outlook submission. It was not supported by the law. It was not supported by the evidence. The burden for a defendant making this submission is the same as a plaintiff making the submission. Under the law, the plaintiff in this case, because the roles are kind of somewhat reversed, not only has to have the ability to see, but also the time, means, and ability to avoid. Without that, this is an erroneous submission. 1705 is the MAI number for this submission. If you look at the defense, it's almost like they're trying to defend a 1704, failure to swerve, stop sign, warning, etc. They're basically trying to argue that Mr. Hayes should have been going slower or done something else even before there's a hazard. The law requires there first to be a hazard. What is the purpose of the law here? The law is designed to create a duty only when a driver has the ability to conform their conduct. That's why the necessary legal ingredient exists that Mr. Hayes had to have the means and ability to avoid.
In this case, depending on how you interpret the evidence, there may have been two hazards. The hazard of someone pulling up on the cross street, as well as Ms. Price. Are there any cases dealing with the issue as to when there is more than one hazard that the driver might need to have a lookout for?
I'm not aware of a case specifically on that point with those facts. However, I think the salient part of Your Honor's question is, when does it become a hazard? If you really look at the defense argument, they're trying to go to the extreme.
And actually, carrying that argument a little further, then neither one would have been a hazard. Both of them would have been potential hazards because there were drivers, but as a person is driving into the intersection, neither are hazards until Ms. Price begins to pull forward.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what I was trying to clarify, because the vehicle to Mr. Hayes' right presented a potential hazard. It was stopped. He has no legal duty to anticipate or react to it until it does create a hazard of an imminent collision. Ms. Price's, the defendant's car, as the defense admits, was a potential hazard. On page 16 of their brief, they say plaintiff, however, from his vantage point, could have seen defendant's car stopped at the intersection through the Bronco had he been keeping a careful lookout. Seeing a stopped vehicle does not create a hazard giving rise to a duty to anticipate negligent conduct by that stopped vehicle.
So even if we were to accept opposing counsel's argument that they might have seen this vehicle through the windows of the other car, you're saying there's no suggestion they would have realized that Ms. Price's vehicle was turning in front of them?
Absolutely correct, because we have to look at what the practical implications of the extension of that argument and creation of a duty would have on the everyday life. If every vehicle on the road stopped or moving created a potential hazard sufficient to raise such a defensive driving duty, traffic would be snarled. Coming up here this morning on a two-lane highway, every car coming the other way at a closing speed over 100 miles an hour would certainly create such a hazard. Do I need to slow and pull over every time? Every time you drive with a green light on the far right-hand curb lane of a four-lane thoroughfare, do you need to slow well below the speed limit? That's not the duty here. That's not the law. It wasn't supported for the submission.
Can I switch you to the other issue on appeal and ask, can you just put anything in a pretrial demand, and as long as you have a specific number, then they have to accept it all, or they're liable for interest later?
First, the direct answer, and then the clarification. No, we are not suggesting you can put anything. And by way of reference, I'll share with you, I believe it was Judge Shrum's, Judge Barney's question in the appellate court below. He said, well, could you propose a demand, a release, and in addition to the payment of money, a free ride on the space shuttle? Well, I think that, you know, he took it to the logical extreme. That's not the point, because that question would be appropriate if the defense made an attempt to accept and then declared difficulty or impossibility.
Do we have to focus on the response to the offer? Because there doesn't need to be. It's the correctness of the offer as it is accepted or not accepted, isn't it? As opposed to shifting the burden to the other side to make a counteroffer to do part of it?
It's both, and let me explain why. The first part you state is the correctness of the offer. The second part is the shifting a burden for a response. As to the correctness of the offer, this offer, in every way, shape, and form, complied with the explicit requirements of the statute, and there's no contest in that regard.
The party that you're asking that interest be imposed against could not have completed that offer by that party's own actions. There are two issues, and one is whether you can put any conditions beyond the payment of money in an offer, and the other is what if those conditions involve conduct by third parties?
Certainly. Let me focus right on that for you, Judge. In reverse order, the conduct by third parties is a misnomer skillfully contorted out of the context of this case. In the Court of Appeals below, that was construed to be mom and dad were not parties to this action.
Even if they're not parties, the person that you're asking that interest be imposed, that person on their own could not comply with your offer.
Whether they're parties or not, the person you're asking for the money.
Okay, two parts. Mom and dad were parties to the original demand release and offer to release all liability.
But not to the lawsuit in which the offer was made.
That came later.
Not to the lawsuit in which this demand was made, right?
That is correct. At the time, there were unresolved factual issues early after the injury, well before suit, that mom and dad may have principal agency and other
whether or not, without focusing on that issue and whether it's relevant, we can go back to that. But if you're asking multiple, you're saying one person must make an offer that they can't do without the consent of other people, whether or not parties, why does that comply with the statute?
And you say other people who were not parties.
No, other people, it doesn't matter. Parties are not parties.
Okay. Yes, if I were asking you, for example, to produce something as part of a settlement, I would have some problems.
If you're asking Judge Stiff to settle, she has to produce me and have me give a statement. Isn't that what the offer did?
No, it did not.
Or produce other policies and so forth.
But it was the policies of mom, dad, and daughter.
Yeah.
The factual circumstances, there was a 4 or 5 vehicle policy, and the only information disclosed was for one vehicle. And we were earned.
I understand why you wanted all that information and why it was relevant and why it was important to find other coverage and all those things. The question is putting it in the settlement offer and if that affects whether or not you get prejudgment interest.
Right. And we don't believe it does. And let me narrow in on that. One, it did not render the agreement unenforceable. There's no evidence of that, no attempt to accept it or enforce it. If we assume different facts, we could get a different result.
What if here he had come back and said, I can't remember what the demand was, but had said, we agree to pay the dollar demand, but we don't agree with the other aspects of your demand.
Again, we could have a different case if
there was... No, but what do we have? What would you say that means? Has he therefore stopped the running of prejudgment interest? Because so, how's he supposed to know what he has to do in order to stop the running of prejudgment interest when he asks for multiple things in the absence of our rule addressing or some case addressing it and telling him, if you want to stop interest, even if you don't like the other conditions, just accept the dollar amount and you can stop it. But in the absence of anything telling that, why is it reasonable to say he had to do that?
Does that make sense? Sure. Similar to Judge Pfeiffer's question earlier, did the carrier have an opportunity to stop the interest? In that case, what could be done in this case is what you're asking. If you look at the letter, it was extremely specific. It even included the release, so there's nothing left open to chance, time frames. All the details were addressed that they were being required to produce.
Yeah, but what if they didn't agree with the parts other than the dollars?
If they didn't agree with it, they could make a counteroffer. Your question
well,
is,
that
would
that kind
cut
of begs
off
the question. Did, I mean, they don't have to make a counteroffer.
Right.
Nothing requires them to make a counteroffer. And the statute on prejudgment interest talks about payment of a claim or settlement of a claim, which suggests that if you would have just made a demand for payment and they would have done nothing, maybe you win, but you made more than a demand for payment of a claim. You made an offer of settlement of a claim, which included more than just payment. And so when they don't accept it, aren't you on, I mean, you're at that point in time, you know, if you really want prejudgment interest, don't you have to limit your demand to just the payment of a claim under the clear language of the statute?
I'll try to answer that as briefly as I can, Judge. No, because there's nothing in the statute that prohibits additional terms such as form of payment, specifics in a release. An offer to settle is more than a dollar amount. This court has been through many other cases about the timing of the demand and suit, certified mail versus no certified mail, punitives versus compensatory, past and future damages, net amounts, court costs, first or second demand when two prejudgment demands have been made, and at no time have those additional terms or conditions of a demand been ruled to void a prejudgment demand. In sum, what we have here, paraphrasing from the wisdom of the Lester v. Sales case, by placing no limitation on what terms a plaintiff may add to their offer, the legislature has answered this question.
Well, in effect, though, then, have you not really gotten more than your demand? Because the demand asked for things you didn't get in the judgment, because it asked for a lot of non-monetary things you didn't get in the judgment.
I believe your question is, would we be entitled to ask for money plus other things?
Well, you're saying, I thought the principle on which you get prejudgment interest is you ask to settle for a certain amount. Yes, demanded a certain amount. The judgment, in fact, was for much more than that. It implies a certain unreasonableness and not, they could have stopped the running of interest by paying that amount early on, so we're going to give you interest on the full judgment. It's their fault. But the reason you can't ask for, by asking for more things and things they were not willing to give for whatever reason, good or bad, in effect, didn't you preclude them from accepting the demand? And if you don't look at it that way, the point is you have to get more in the judgment than you asked for in the demand for the statute to be triggered. Since you didn't get the non-monetary things you asked for, should we look at that and deciding whether you actually get more in the judgment than you asked for in the demand?
No. We satisfied the statute got the judgment for nearly twice. That triggers the prejudgment interest. The fact that we requested more, that after we filed suit within 90 days we got, they had the ability to avoid prejudgment interest by stepping up with their conduct and saying, here's the information.
They couldn't avoid it by giving you the money you demanded, though.
I'm sorry?
They could not have avoided it by giving you the dollars you demanded, because you asked for more, too.
Such an attempt to accept on less than the full terms demanded, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, may I approach the easel purpose?
Most certainly. Although it's a little low for us to see it.
There's a lot of reference in the record to this, so I thought
yeah,
I would
okay.
Yeah, as you can say, we can't see it. It's too low to the bench.
Move it back?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, or maybe just take it to council table and hold it. Yeah, there. That
a little farther back.
Or further back is just, that's fine.
That's
there
great.
We go. Thank you.
Right.
The bench is in the way otherwise. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm John Mullen. I represent the respondent in this matter, Patricia Price. As you've heard from opposing counsel, there are two issues before you today. One deals with the submissibility of the court's instruction on the issue of the plaintiff's comparative fault for failure to keep a careful lookout. The second issue regards the trial court's determination that the plaintiff was not entitled to an award of prejudgment interest pursuant to 408.040. I'm going to address the underlying fact and only insofar as they affect the issues here today. Now, I think one of the things that noteworthy about the briefing in this case, we disagree on a lot, but one thing that we do agree on is what the standard of review is for the first issue, that being the submissibility of the comparative fault. The standard of review is that this court and the Southern District have to review this, review the facts in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict. So the pre-existing case law requires us to disregard all facts except insofar as they support the jury's verdict. Now, I think if you look at the plaintiff's brief in this matter, they make a lot of arguments about other facts which are non-supportive of the jury verdict. And I'll be the first to concede, there was sufficient evidence to submit my client's fault to the jury. She admitted that she felt like she was partly at fault. But the question for this court is not to weigh those facts. The question is, were there any substantial facts which supported a submission of the plaintiff's comparative fault? And I point out in the plaintiff's brief, just to show you what I think is an attempt by the plaintiff to cherry pick the facts, he states at page 11 in his recitation of the facts, quote, talking about the accident reconstructionist, in his opinion, it was not likely that the plaintiff swerved from the left lane to the right lane while he was in the blind zone, as was suggested by defendant's attorney. He's saying, plaintiff says, or defendant says this, but the accident reconstruction says something more favorable. So we're going to present those facts to you.
You had in your brief that the defendant was in the left-hand, I think, southbound lane and moved over into the right lane. Who testified to that?
The plaintiff, or my client did, the defendant. She says that she pulls up to this intersection. It's two lanes going north and south. There's a center turn, not a lane, but just the striping on the road, and she puts on her left turn signal to turn left. At that same moment, a Bronco, some sort of SUV, comes up and pulls up in front of her on the other side of the intersection, waiting to turn left in front of her lane, creating what was called, I call it a blind zone in the testimony. The plaintiff's attorney referred to it as a zone of obscurity. But if you see that shaded area on this exhibit, the expert put that together to show us the blind zone that these motorcycles were traveling through. And my client says that she saw a gap between these motorcycles, that the plaintiff was in the left lane, his companion, the lead motorcycle, was in the right lane. She says she stopped, and as she began to make, she came to a complete stop, as the first motorcycle came by, she starts to make her turn. And this is the critical policy issues this court has to consider. On a failure to keep a careful lookout, the Southern District and the Maslowski case talked about keeping a lookout for other vehicles. And the Southern District cited the Maslowski case, said that this plaintiff had no duty to take any evasive action until the other vehicle became visible. I think that is a misstatement
of
Missouri law. And here's why. What happened in this case is the first motorcyclist came along, they're riding in tandem, and his testimony is, and the plaintiff agreed with this, that they ride together as a safety issue, that his job as the lead motorcyclist is to alert those behind him if there is a dangerous situation up ahead. The plaintiff's testimony is that when he's about 170 feet away from this intersection, he focuses off to the right, and he doesn't see his companion motorcyclist in front of him. Had he been looking ahead at his companion motorcyclist, who said it's his duty to advise him of dangerous conditions, he would have seen his companion motorcyclist waving at my client like this as he goes to the intersection.
What was the dangerous situation at that point?
Well, the dangerous
situation was, your client wasn't already turning into the lane, was it?
As the first motorcycle was coming through, the first motorcycle could see my client was beginning her turn. He knows there's a motorcycle behind him. He knows there's a blind zone behind him. He sees this first domino going out, and he's trying to warn my client and the motorcycle behind him, slow down.
So if somebody, are you not saying that if just some random motorist waved at you that you should then have to slow down, as opposed to
And I think, you know, the classic example I look at, I think we've all been in the situation where we've been in the city and some truck, delivery truck, is backing out of a blind alleyway and some co-employee, the truck driver, is out in the roadway stopping traffic so they can back out. I can't see that truck backing out of the blind alleyway yet, but I can see somebody in the roadway saying, stop, slow down. Now, is a reasonably careful driver required to take heed of that warning and to slow down? Don't know exactly what's going on. I don't know why that guy's out in the roadway, but he's doing something. Am I under no duty to change? I'm driving the speed limit. I've got the right-of-way.
So the lack of careful lookout was not his not seeing this car, because, you normally are allowed to drive along the highway. You don't have to, as opposing counsel says, have your foot in the brakes the whole time thinking somebody might turn left in front of me. You're saying it was failure to see his fellow motorcyclist signal him.
I guess my response to that, Judge, is to say that it's a fact-by-fact situation. It might depend on what this pedestrian is doing or this person giving the warning, and you have to look at each situation independent of perhaps the other cases. So the question in this case is, with the motorcyclist going like that, should the plaintiff have been, instead of looking off to his right, been focusing ahead at his companion motorcyclist, had seen that warning, and slowed down? And it's clearly admitted that he was not looking ahead. He was focused off to the right because he saw another car stop at that
intersection. Which I think is very different than the case you argue in your brief. The case you argue in your brief, the guy's watching somebody fishing, which is very different than checking out conditions of the roadway. And there's a real question in my mind as to whether one imposes a duty on a driver that they have to be looking in one particular place when they have a duty to be surveying the circumstances.
Absolute fair observation. And my response to that is to say this. Our expert testimony, reviewing these facts in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict, my client begins her turn, and the plaintiff is about 4 seconds away from impact. And so the testimony is that he is focusing on this right car the whole time. If this is a situation where the testimony was he glanced to the right just because his car was pulling up and glanced back and boom, it happened like that within a second, maybe that's a different situation. But what we have here, based upon the facts viewed most favorably to the jury's verdict, is that his attention is diverted for up to 4 full seconds.
I thought your expert's testimony was that had the plaintiff been driving less than 30 miles an hour, the accident would have been avoided.
Correct. The plaintiff was traveling. That was the assumption that was made. That was the testimony at trial, and there was nothing that contradicted that he was traveling 30 miles an hour. Based upon that, the expert calculated back that at the outside, the farthest he could be away would be 171 feet when my client started to make her turn, which coincides with the companion motorcyclist waving the fingers. So based upon that chain of events, I think it's a fair supposition of the facts to say that the jury could have believed that when this companion motorcyclist was giving the warning, my client's starting her turn, and he's 171 feet away doing 30 miles an hour. And clearly the evidence...
And how slowly would he have gone, and how soon would he have had to put on the brakes in order to have avoided it?
I'm sorry, Judge.
How, how soon would he have had to put on the brakes and seen this, and how slowly would he have had to be going to have avoided your client because the client was turning straight in front of him?
We cited in our brief examples from our accident reconstructionist about his testimony about the ability to avoid the accident. And he's asked questions. This is page 372. And by the time Mr. Hayes is somewhere in the area approaching that intersection, it's too late for him to avoid the collision. Do you remember stating that in your sworn testimony? At 30 miles per hour, yes, that's true. So the gist of his testimony was, had he been going slower, and the argument I made to the jury was, had he heeded the warning that the accident
But he would, I mean, your car, he couldn't have avoided the car. He would have had to slow enough to stop before he got to the intersection.
That's the second policy issue, I think, that is important for the court to consider in resolving this issue. I don't know if the court, this was not cited in the briefing because there's a case that came out of the Eastern District last week, the Barra case, which most of us looked at because of the tort reform issues that were addressing that. But that case also dealt with a failure to keep a careful lookout review. And in that case, the court went to great pains to say expert testimony is not required. If you look at the Southern District opinion in this case, it seems to suggest that unless you've got an accident reconstructionist that says he was 171 feet away doing 30 miles an hour, the stopping distance is X, and so he could have stopped in distance Y, that it doesn't make a submissible case, and that has not and never has been the law. So if we're going to say that, one, I think we have sufficient evidence that it could have been avoided based upon our accident reconstructionist testimony that had he been going slower than 30 miles an hour, the accident could have been avoided. But even if you set that aside, the law in Missouri always has been that you don't need expert testimony on that. Now, I think that at some point, perhaps you do, because it's not within the knowledge of the jurors. And I think if we look at a situation, if somebody was 300 feet away from a pedestrian standing in a roadway traveling 5 miles an hour, do you need expert testimony to say that they could stop at 5 miles an hour from 300 feet away? Probably not. What about 200 feet doing 10 miles an hour? You don't need it there either. I think that's clearly within the common knowledge. What about 170 feet in 4 seconds? Clearly not. I mean, we're talking more than half the length of a football field, 60 yards away, and had he been looking at 30 miles an hour, could have stopped well before the accident, could have slowed down such that he could have maneuvered around it. There's an endless possibility of ways he could have reacted had he been keeping a careful lookout. And that's really the gist of what we're at here. The Southern District's opinion on this, it doesn't come out and say this, I'll be candid about that, but if a practitioner reading that is getting ready to try a case, whether you're the plaintiff trying to submit on failure to keep a careful lookout or the defense thinking about comparative fault, all of a sudden you're thinking, on a precautionary measure, I better go out and get an accident reconstructionist just because these cases seem to be evolving to the point where you have to prove your case with mathematical precision.
And if you don't have an expert, in this case, your client did not see him until the impact. Is that right?
Well, no, I think that's right. But being capable of seeing, she came out of the blind zone. I think the testimony from my accident reconstructionist was it was about 44 feet between the time that the plaintiff came out of the blind zone to the time of impact, which took about 0.8 seconds.
And so is there any evidence that she did anything to react to that? Because she's pulling directly across in front of him, which makes it pretty hard.
If your question is there testimony that my client failed in her duty?
No, I'm thinking as if she's traveling to be perpendicular to him, how is he going to avoid the accident? What was the testimony about if he'd been driving less than 30 miles an hour, what he could have done to avoid the accident?
He could have slowed down.
How would slowing down have avoided the accident? Because she would still have been there and he still would have hit her. If you're saying he had to stop in the middle of the road because somebody went like this,
Even though he
couldn't see her and didn't know what they were referring to until right when he hit her.
If he heeds that warning, and I guess you're asking me to speculate about what could have occurred if he had been focusing ahead.
We're asking you to tell us what's in the record that he had the ability to do to avoid the accident, considering that she was pulling perpendicular into the lane he was traveling.
The accident reconstructionist testified, and I just read one of those snippets a moment ago, I'll read another one now, and he said, if the vehicle's traveling 30 miles an hour, there's probably going to be a collision. If it's traveling slower than that, there's an opportunity to be avoided. But set that aside, my whole point is, though, I don't think you need that with...
You've got like a minute and a half on the other issue. I realize you've taken too much...
On the interest.
On the interest issue. Did you want to address that? Prejudgment interest? I realize you've taken your whole time on this.
The situation with regards to the prejudgment interest, they made an 040 demand. The Southern District went to great pains to list out all the items that were required from a third party in order to meet the terms of that demand. And I think I only have a minute left, so I'll rush through this. I think there's a couple of strong public policy considerations this court should take into consideration in ruling on this. One, if you allow a plaintiff to make an 040 demand based upon the actions of some third parties, you're going to open up the floodgates to post-trial litigation, evidentiary hearings, and discovery about whether those third-party actions were readily obtainable by the defendant in the case.
Well, what about in this case when it was a minor involved in the accident and the third party was her parents? Does that make a difference?
It's still, well, the facts in that, and I think it was misleading the way that this has been phrased, but he said that there was no response, that we didn't do anything. If you look at the demand, it's the third 040 demand he made. The first one was for the policy limits of $250,000, which have since been paid, and the first one required all of these other things that wanted, and the parents said no. That's not germane to this proceeding, but I'm sure Mr. Rance will acknowledge that as an officer of the court. The question for this court to consider is, based upon the requirement of these third parties to do something, is that a valid 040 demand?
But is there a distinction between, you know, third parties who obviously aren't parties to the lawsuit, but third parties who are the owners of the insurance policy and responsible for this minor? Is there a difference there?
With regards to this 040 demand, it required not only the actions of my client and her parents, but also other parties. Any vehicle that was readily available for our use, my client's parents' use, such as an employer's vehicle, all the titles to those vehicles would have to be produced. All the insurance policies to those vehicles would have to be produced. There is a kind of a floodgate of documents that could be produced in this situation.
What if they were all things that were in your possession or control? Or here they'd asked only for only your client's policies and your different situation. And what if they'd asked for, my concern is if we're extending it beyond asking for dollars, what if they'd said, and give me trade secrets or your list of customers or other kinds of things, which are clearly not in this situation. But if we say you can ask for things other than dollars, is there a limit to that, or is there maybe an obligation on your part to counteroffer with the dollars if you want to object to the additions? Or?
Well, that's the next case coming down the line, because there was a counteroffer on the second or the first of the second demand. This was the third one that he made after those terms weren't met because of the ancillary issues. So if you're asking me, if this court were to draw a rule about what would be an appropriate ancillary item that could trigger the 040 statute, I think the existing case law talks about this analogous in terms of contract law. You got an offer and acceptance. And if the law in Missouri has always been that if acceptance can only be made by the actions of third parties, not to the contract, then it's not a valid contract. And I don't think this court should stray and start creating special contract rules, which is going to open up issues in other non-related cases.
The statute asks, or the statute requires there either be a demand for payment or an offer for settlement. What's your understanding? Because a demand for payment would seem to be just the dollar amount. What's the additional language of an offer for settlement that's
absolutely
in the statute?
Good. And if you're looking at this from a hypothetical situation, let's suppose you have a demand for $25,000 plus they want production of some other unrelated item, a non-monetary item, something such as that. Is that a demand for payment? I think that the whole statute...
No, the demand for payment would seem to be pay a monetary amount. What's the language in the statute that gives? It says they have to either make a demand for payment or an offer of settlement? The offer for settlement language?
Well, that's just it. I think whether you call the plaintiff's demand for settlement or the plaintiff is coming to you with an offer of settlement, I view that as being one and the same. It's the plaintiff's communication to the tortfeasor, I'm willing to settle upon these terms. This is my demand for settlement. This is my offer for settlement.
And we're required to interpret that the legislature meant something by including the two terms rather than assuming they just all mean the same thing. So you don't, other than you think that means a demand for a monetary payment.
I think so, because if you look at the next line of that statute, it says that if the amount of the judgment or order exceeds the demand for payment, So it has to exceed the demand for payment. How can a judgment requiring production of non-monetary items,
well,
the demand
there's
is
a, there's
more
a,
than just the monetary
right,
amount.
But
the demand is for a monetary there, amount plus other things. So how can the judgment exceed that amount?
Well, sir, there's another or after that that says or settlement offer. What about this? Is this a demand for payment or a settlement offer? I want the policy limits of $50,000 and an apology letter. And you're the insurance company, and you say, here we are. You can have the $50,000. I can't make her say she's sorry. Okay, to me, whenever you say I want the apology letter, that's not a demand for payment. That's a settlement offer. And if you just ask for the money, that's a demand for payment. Now, how am I wrong in my analysis?
Well, I think we get in. There's some semantics going on there about the demand versus the offer. But I think the rule ought to be from this court that if there is a demand for payment that allows production by the party upon whom the demand is made and they can meet that, then it's a valid offer or demand. If it requires the involvement of third parties, then it probably exceeds the scope of offer or and is improper demand.
I think the Brown case said it must be readily ascertainable.
I'm sorry?
The Brown case says it must be readily ascertainable.
The demand?
The Brown case,
yeah.
Brown versus Dunham, that a demand must be sufficiently definite and the amount must be readily ascertainable. But that's talking about the amount.
Right, and I think that's a fair supposition that if the policy limits are known and everybody knows what we're talking about in terms of the monetary amount, then I think it's a better practice to have the actual number in the demand letter. But in that case, the policy limits were not readily ascertainable, so I think the court reached a different result in that case. I see my time is up. I ask that the trial court's judgment be affirmed.
Before you start, this case puts an end to the wonderful joke of the lawyer trying the business case who can't answer the judge's question and says instead, I would have understood this case a lot better if it happened in an intersection.
Well put, and I remain unable to discern which issue finds greater significance with the court. I'll try to divide my 2.5 minutes remaining as best I can between the two issues. Yes, Judge.
Can you answer my concern, which is that if you put in things that someone really couldn't be expected to offer, I mean, I just think it's open to abuse. You could ask for trade secrets or the trip to the moon or whatever it may be, and therefore sort of guarantee that no one's going to accept the demand and set it up for later. Not just, that would, but how well, do you?
Sure, the space shuttle example. Okay.
Assuming you own the space shuttles.
Well, or
whatever.
Certainly. Basically, poisoning the demand, if you will, with unrelated, not even logically or remotely associated, impossible terms. If we had that case, Judge, I think that would be easy for the trial court and the appellate courts to decide. That would be a clear abuse of the statute. There are.
But how do we draw a line without just saying, well, we think this was okay to ask, well, this wasn't, this was, I mean, the statute doesn't make any of those distinctions here.
No, that's,
so
it's the legislature's job to set the terms, which they have, and they've not said additional terms are prohibited, mm-hmm. so it's not for this court to read that into it. Mm-hmm. And
however, if you take Judge Fisher's, and he's saying it's an offer
right.
of settlement
mm-hmm.
if you get an apology along with the money, the statute goes on to say the judgment must exceed the offer or the demand for settlement.
Mm-hmm.
And that judgment can never exceed that if it does not have the apology. And the judgment's never going to have the non-monetary factors or information.
Certainly. But also let's, instead of expanding the example, let's contract it. Applying the defense argument precisely would render the statute to apply to a demand and only a demand and not form of payment, not form of release, indemnity, confidentiality, mm-hmm. everything else that we know in day-to-day practice of law are elements of a settlement, offer, negotiation, and complete agreement.
What if the defendant had said, I'll pay the $50,000 on Judge Fisher's example, we'll pay the $50,000, but no apology?
In that situation, I think that the parties, again, a different set of facts, but they do have a dilemma there as to whether that would be enforceable. Their defense here is that there's this third parties, and Mr. Mullen said third parties not to the contract. Mom and Dad were not third parties.
So what
if
they said, we'll pay the money, but can't do the third party, we'll pay the money, that's it? How do you have interest on this third party?
Had they previously done that in response to your other off demands?
No, they had not. The history was there were four or five, a number of offers made by the plaintiff. This was the only pre-judgment offer made during the course of those negotiations.
How would you handle that when they pay? Well, we'll pay the monetary, we can't do the other. Would you say you're still entitled to the interest? We'll pay the money, but we won't do the other.
If the defendant made a good faith, legitimate effort to comply with the terms, and the reason was we can't compel the insured to give an apology, then I think that that's a real close call, and they probably have done everything they can to conform their conduct.
But just offering the money wouldn't be sufficient.
I'm sorry?
But just offering the money and saying we're not going any further would not be sufficient.
Which is what they did here. They never attempted or claimed ambiguity or impossibility or difficulty. That's correct.
Are there any further questions? Not the case will be taken under submission.